a bunch of ways of trying to get a dark matter, some of them much older than I am, like the gravitational force, Zwicky, all that stuff, rotation curves, lensing, CMB. These are kind of the classic ways that we know the dark matter is there. Then there's direct detection. You can put your cryogenic xenon or whatever you want in a hole in the ground and see if something runs into it. And those experiments have been getting better and better quickly and are really starting to get into interesting parts of parameter space.
Then you can look for what's often called indirect detection to distinguish it from the direct nuclear scattering experiments. But I tend to call it astrophysical detection because then we're talking about the gamma rays or particles or whatever from the annihilations of the dark matter. And then most recently, we've been working on other things dark matter might do. It might not just annihilate, it might scatter. There was a theory 7 years ago, Spergel and Steinhardt were talking about elastic scattering of dark matter. But then Neil and I have been talking in the last year about inelastic scattering. So I'll just focus on these last two things. But the whole point here is, you know, for 70 years, dark matter has been this sort of inert stuff that's along for the ride, but it doesn't do anything interesting. But it is the majority of mass in the universe. The non-dark part of particle physics has a very rich structure. And why should the dark matter be the simplest possible thing? Maybe it's the second or third simplest thing. So this will be an attempt to just explore the parameter space and think a little more generally than we usually do with, say, SUSY neutralinos or something. OK, so as you know, for a thermal relic of the Big Bang, which is how we like to make our weakly interacting mass of particles, the larger the annihilation cross-section, this is sigma b here, the thermal average of the cross-section times the velocity, the larger that is, the less the freeze-out density you end up with. And that's nice, because we know the dark matter density today. We know this co-moving number density. Well, OK, so it's actually the mass density today that gets predicted by this, because the time at which this happens also depends on the particle mass, because it freezes out when the temperature of the universe is about mass over 20 or so. So it's actually the co-moving mass density today is determined by sigma v at freeze-out time. So that's interesting. That gives us some handle on what the annihilation cross-section ought to be, even if we don't know anything about what the particle is. So now after freeze-out, the annihilation is negligible, pretty much, until galaxies form. And then today we have structure and dents in the center of galaxies, and you can have a little bit of annihilation again. So in the inner Milky Way, the annihilation rates are high enough that we might be able to see something. And this was actually, you know, when I started thinking about this kind of thing 4 years ago, this was a hurdle for me to get over. And I think it's a big hurdle for most astronomers to get over. Because if they hear about dark matter annihilation, they say, oh, crackpots. Those must be theoretical physicists or some other kind of crackpot. And, you know, then I started talking to people and looking at these totally generic arguments. And it's actually quite likely that something like this could be going on.
That you need to freeze out correctly, you plausibly have observable annihilation at the center of our galaxy.
Right, exactly.
But you very sensitively depend on whether you're in S wave
or P wave, yeah. If you're in P wave, it could be five orders of magnitude lower.
It could be like 4 orders of magnitude in spread, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you want it to be which?
S wave.
Yeah, S wave. S wave is when sigma B is constant with B. If it's P wave, it goes down as 1 over V squared.
Oh, right.
Or up is V squared. Sorry.
Is there any reason to prefer one over the other?
You mean theoretically? There are models that have both one or the other. It depends on plotting this.
Although generically, it seems like the models have some of each, where the amplitudes are similar in the high velocity limit, isn't it? Kind of the generic situation.
Something has to be special to prohibit S-wave annihilation, otherwise.
Oh, very easily.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, no, I mean, you can.
Oh, yeah, you can always design a theory that does. That's no problem to have no S-wave. But I mean, if you just look at the, you know, the MSSM space that people usually, you know, they put their 100 million models in the MSSM space because their name is Ted Baltz, and then they look at the annihilation cross-sections today of all of those. You see a variation of a few orders of magnitude, it's true. But models that are mostly S-wave are not all that rare. But that's something to keep in mind. This could be off by orders of magnitude. OK, So there have been a few signals that I just want to run through here, some of which are more tentative than others. None of them are incredibly well established. But it can be instructive, I think, to engineer a theory to design, design a theory to explain a list of things. And even if not all of the things actually turn out to be true in the end, it's guiding your intuition for what kinds of observables are related to what kinds of theoretical structures. So let's just go through these. There's an excess observed by the EGRIT telescope at the Compagamari Observatory that's in the few GeV photon energy range. You have these few GeV gamma rays, and there are too many of them in the center of the galaxy. Okay, so that's one thing. HEAT is the High Energy Astrophysics Telescope, I guess, detected positrons and antiprotons and other things. There are a couple of different versions of it. There were three different flights. All of them found excess positrons in the, I say 10 to 50, maybe it's 10 to 30, but tens of GeV range. And by excess, I mean you know how many positrons you would need to get as a lower bound from just the normal cosmic rays in the galaxy interacting with interstellar medium, and you get pions and cascades out of that, and you get some positrons from that. So there are more positrons than there should be in this energy range. Now, lots of mechanisms of acceleration just accelerate what's already there, which would be electrons. To make positrons, it's more convenient to use something in particle physics that makes equal numbers of electrons and positrons. And this is, again, kind of a tantalizing energy scale because it's getting up toward the weak scale.
WMAP excess, this is something I worked on a few years ago, and then we've just finished a paper recently on this. This is excess microwaves from the center of the galaxy. And this is, this is microwaves now. Why is this a high energy phenomenon? Well, we think these are coming from these are the synchrotron emission from high energy, E plus, E minus, in the center of the galaxy. And curiously, they're in the same, kind of tens of GeV range to 100 GeV range, something like that, in order to make the microwaves we see. Now, there are lots of other ways to make microwaves, and I'll go into this, why we think these are special. Okay, and then there's what you could call the OSI excess. It's actually a very old signal, 511 kV gammas from the center of the galaxy. And there are just way too many 511 kVs. Again, if you calculate how many positrons you make from secondary cosmic rays from the usual cosmic ray spectrum hitting the ISM, there are just way too many of these.
What the conventional astrophysics feeling is about those four things? Given that conventional astrophysicists don't believe in annihilation?
The conventional...
Presuming most people believe this has something to do with the black hole at the center, right?
Right. So to be, not too flippant, but a little flippant, I would say, EGRIT, it's a piece of junk, wasn't designed to observe at super high energies. GLAST will do this much, much better. So just, you should ignore this result until GLAST is launched in the next few months. And then we'll know. Like the first day of GLAST data will be better than this result. But I've got to talk to the people who analyzed the data, and I believe that they know what they're doing. So I'm taking the results seriously. HEAT, again, I have had long conversations with the people who got this data. I think people tend to be kind of dismissive. They say, we can't explain where the positrons are coming from, so build another satellite. Because it's not, it's something like 4 or 5 sigma when you combine all of the missions and all of the energy bins, right? It's not hugely significant. The WMAP axis is above reproach, because I did that one. And then the last one here, this has been around for 36 years, actually. Johnson et al., 1972, was the first paper. And in the paper, he explains how it cannot be positron annihilation because there's just way too much orders of magnitude. It would be ridiculous. So then he comes up with some other ideas. But now we know this gamma ray line is at 511 point, lots of digits. It's exactly the mass of the electron. So there's no question where it comes from. And then this has been superseded by integral, as you will see in the next slide.
Or do people just say we don't know, or do people say it's the black hole?
Well, so what people say for this one is it's supernovae, and I'll show you why that's wrong. And then they say, okay, if it's not supernovae, maybe it's microquasars. But so I'll come to all of this. Okay, I wanted to just say that, you know, we are getting a lot of new data soon. So EGRID is getting superseded by BLAST, which was going to launch in the fourth or fifth quarter. I think we're up to sixth quarter 2007, because it's April next year is when it's going to launch. But we refuse to change the year. It's going to be 2007, just sixth quarter. Pamela, which is Italian, so it's not Pamela, it's Pamela, is in orbit and has collected something like 100 million events already. So it's measuring the particle spectrum, positrons, antiprotons, lots of different goodies, and I'll show you some really preliminary data from that. Planck supersedes WMAP, obviously, and we'll do way better on the microwave signal, but I'll tell you a lot about that in a minute. And then Integral, of course, is the new spacecraft. It has actually collected that many more 511 kV photons than anyone else. That's not why it's better. It has a better spectrograph. And so it's, you know, spectrally, it's determining interesting things. Okay, let me just say a few words about Pamela, because this is practically hot off the press. This thing's in orbit. It can measure antiprotons up to about 200 GeV, positrons up to about 300, electrons up to about 400, protons up to about 700. And in 3 years, it should get quite a few of those. So you can actually expect to get a decent-looking spectrum. So this supersedes heat in the other experiments like it, with sensitivity one or two orders of magnitude better. So for example, just in the helium and hydrogen spectrum. So this is the hydrogen spectrum. You like the error bars there? Kind of small? And they go all the way down like that. So that's a beautiful particle spectrum. We want to see a spectrum like that for electrons and positrons. Helium looks good. Okay, so since these are particles coming in, you don't know what direction they're coming from. So it's just the tally of particles near Earth. This can totally get modulated on the low energy end.
For example, a solar flare happens, right, and this goes up a factor of 1,000. So you can't believe the numbers in here. But out here, these don't really depend at all on what the sun is doing. So I have to, there it goes. Boom. Isn't that great? Look at that. That blast wave coming off across the sun, that did that. So you have to beware, you know, less than a GeV or a few GeV, you can't believe anything. Okay, so this is the excess that we're trying to get at. This is all the old data. Heat, there's also something called AMS-01, and I don't even remember what TS-93 is, and so on. And then this Moskalenko and Strong line, this is the best guess calculation of what this spectrum should look like. And so they expected this. The data points seem to be up here. So it looks like in the tens of GeV range, we have quite a few more positrons than we expect. So this is just the positron fraction, right? And they're just, you know, 6% or 7% positrons, not 3%. And it would be nice to know why that is. So it's possible that Pamela will come back and just be right on this line. And then we'll know all these people were insane. But the error bars will be much smaller. So I'm very excited to that. I've preemptively invited the PI of this project to Harvard to give a talk about when I think they'll release the data. So we'll see, but nothing yet. Okay, and I'd recommend that you all do the same. So everything is happening all at once. Like in the next year, it's gonna be a very big year for this kind of thing. So what are you guys laughing about back there?
Strategy of inviting people. She just said the strategy of inviting people when the data is supposed to be released worked really well for WMAP.
Yeah.
That's right. Amber, not me. I didn't say it.
Right. Well, you have to factor in max for 6 or 8 months or 2 years or whatever.
Why isn't Olivia left?
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's a really mean thing to say. Shock.
Amber said it.
No proof.
Anyway, we're moving along. There's a lot happening soon. The three of these things I mentioned, the excess positrons at high energy, the excess gamma rays at high energy, and the microwaves produced by excess particles at high energy, they're all, you know, high energy meaning tens to hundreds of GeV kind of thing. this 511 kV line appears to be totally different. Okay. So let's just consider what these measurements are a little more carefully. The 511 kV line and continuum from the positron annihilation has been observed just forever, like I said. Currently, they'd like to characterize it as a 6 degree or 8 degree, depending on the paper you read, but the most recent is a 6 degree Foltz half max Gaussian in the center of the galaxy. This is a little difficult because you have this coded aperture mask thing with a really complicated response function. And so you can't say, here's a map of the 511 kV gamma rays. You have to say, here's a map that's consistent with the 511 kV gamma rays. So you have to have some kind of model you filter this through. So they usually say, well, it's a Gaussian with some size, and then maybe there's a disk component that's correlated with molecular gas, and, you know, wave your hands a little bit.
Make a map, right?
In principle, but you're always doing this in inversion where you've got this thing with a horrendous response function because it's sensitive to a funny combination of positions on the sky because of the coded aperture maps.
Yeah.
And then you observe with a whole bunch of different offsets, and then you kind of invert something and hope for the best.
Since when is Finkbeiner afraid of that?
But I mean, what we need here is seriously the kind of revolution that happened in X-rays. When I was a grad student, back in my day, we didn't have Chandra. And people said, oh, you'll never get an X-ray telescope that has better than 1 degree resolution. It's just impossible because you can't make something that images and has a focal plane that you put a detector in. And then they invented the concentric grazing, you know, mirrors, and then it was fine. So we went from kind of degree to arc second just almost instantly. And so if we could do the same thing with gamma rays and have arc second resolution in an imaging thing, I mean, that would revolutionize this whole business. So somebody needs to invent that. Okay, so this thing, nevertheless, is an impressive instrument, especially spectrally. It has a huge spectral range, 20 kV to 8 MeV, and that's important because it gets a lot of different lines, not just 511. Pretty good area, field of view, et cetera, et cetera. It's launched 5 years ago, still functioning very nicely. Here it is. That's the instrument in question with its funny mask in front of it. So with this same spectrograph, you can observe other lines, like 1.8 MeV aluminum 26 line is the second most interesting line to observe. What's neat about this is it comes from supernovae. It comes from, you know, it's tracing massive star formation because it only has a million-year half-life. So anywhere you see aluminum 26, that's where some stars just blew up, okay? And so you can look at a map of this and get a sense of where the star formation is in the galaxy in a completely independent way from looking at your other tracers of star formation that astronomers usually use. And you see exactly what you expect. In the plane of the galaxy, and especially in the center of the galaxy, there's a lot of star formation. Here in the Cygnus star-forming region, there's a lot of star formation, so it's well-named. You see the spectral line is there. Okay, so then this is great. If the 511 kV line came from supernovae, it would look like this, right? So.
Positrons might be drawn into the center by magnetic fields.
Yeah, I've never understood that. Usually, if you have some magnetic fields and you throw some particles in, they go to the region of lower fields, not higher fields. I just don't understand how they could go into the center. But yes, there are papers that say that. Okay, so
most of this annihilation goes through positronium, which, as you all probably know, is when the E plus and E minus come together and form a little atom shortly before annihilating. And so they can have their spins, you know, in a singlet or triplet state. And so 3/4 of the annihilations are actually orthopositronium, and they go to 3-photon continuum. And 1/4 of the annihilations go to 2-photon 511 kV. And so you get a spectrum like this. So that's the 3-photon continuum, the line, and then the underlying power law that's always there from other things. So, does this positronium emission trace star formation? Drum roll, please.
No. Okay, that's what it looks like. Big ball in the center. Faintly, so faint you can't see it, there is a disk here. And so this is consistent with the number of positrons you expect from I mean, it's more than consistent. There's actually a measurement that's different from zero, and is consistent with the number of positrons we expect from supernovae, from all that star formation you just saw in the 26 line. So it looks like it should, and then there's this thing at least 10 times brighter in the center here than you would have expected from the supernovae. And that's coming from something else, I claim. And as David Hogg was asking earlier, you know, you can go down a list of lots of exotic astrophysical things that could maybe do that. But with every one of them, you have the problem, why is this only happening in the center of the galaxy and not everywhere in the disk? Why isn't it proportional to the total amount of ISM, or the total number of stars, or the total amount of recent star formation, or
just anything else? Why is it all here? Well, at least if you have an explanation related to dark matter, then it is somewhat reasonable why it would be concentrated in the center and not look like the disk. But for most of the kind of conventional astrophysics explanation, you should see the disk there.
The Cygnus, or whatever the star-forming regions in the disk?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that they pounded on Cygnus for a long time, trying to see a 511 kV line there. So if you can see the noise map of this, there's almost as much weight here as there is here, because they were sure they would see 511 kV line. And the claim is there's nothing too special going on there.
Is there a source having to do with the black hole that you might expect?
So that's an interesting question, too. If the black hole is usually accreting at the rate it's accreting right now, so you know, if we're in a steady state solution here, then it can't possibly be making its particles. If something happened a million years ago and went kablooey, then that's different. I mean, everything I'm going to tell you assumes we don't live in a special time and we're in a steady state.
Well, but you could imagine that we had an active galactic nucleus at some point.
Yeah, we almost certainly did, but it has to be, actually it doesn't have to be terribly recent.
Isn't the time scale like a million years or something for things to diffuse and annihilate?
No,
I guess it's shorter than that.
So for the high energy, for the E plus E minus that come from annihilations, it's kind of a million year time scale. These actually have a much longer time scale. So what you care about more for these is the average duty cycle over maybe 100 million years rather than. So I was misspeaking a little. For the things I'm going to show you next, you care about what's happened in the last half million years.
Is that consistent with this point source?
It is not consistent with the point source. That's very important. The resolution of the instrument is about three times better than the size of this blob. And so they have said that it can be, if it's a linear combination of point sources, it's no fewer than 7 or 12. They have different numbers in their different papers.
But is that the fusion length? I mean, in a time scale of, say, roughly 100 million years, would that be more or less the angular size you'd expect?
I wouldn't be surprised if they could diffuse that far. We actually don't understand thoroughly the diffusion in the center of the galaxy. Igor Moskalenko is a real expert on that, and he told us last summer when we were calculating something that we could fudge the numbers around by factors of a few or several because it's really not very well known. Okay, so rather than dwell on the possibilities for conventional astrophysics, I'm going to tell you another way to do this. No. I.e., it doesn't look like supernova. So, this is, you know, all the things I just said. The other thing about supernovae, by the way, is there's a paper here that says even if you took all of the supernovae in the galaxy and somehow did manage to bring the positrons into the center and have them annihilate at the center, which strikes me as ludicrous. you actually still don't have enough positrons because the escape fraction from supernova
remnants we know about is too low, where we could actually measure it. They've taken an integral here and pounded on supernova remnants to look at the positrons, you know, from supernova that popped off in the last 1,000 years, and they can't detect anything. So. So after 37 years of work, we don't know where the positrons come from. Okay, so people lost no time in cooking up dark matter ideas to explain this. Yeah?
I different types of supernovae, and I don't know, is that, when you say supernovae, and you assume there's star formation, there's supernova, and I don't know, it could be type 1A, I don't know, is that?
Type 1A has produced a lot of positrons because of the nickel 56, and then that decays through positrons. It's true the type 2s are a bit different because they don't really go that route. The thought seems to be that type 1As would probably be the workhorse for looking at, for producing the positrons. And so they're looking at type 1A remnants. Although you're never exactly sure what.
Would they trace the star formations?
1As wouldn't trace star formations.
Yeah, 1As wouldn't trace star formations.
Okay, but you were telling us about the star formations. So, I mean, there is no reason to believe a bunch of all of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true, but why are all the type 1As in the center of the galaxy then? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess they should
have.
You know
why
can't
the LMSDs?
They just.
Why can't they? Is it produced positrons?
Sorry, are those preferentially in the center?
Those would not trace star formation. Those would be down in the bulge, you know, as readily as down in the disk. I don't know. I mean, whether or not you can get the bulge to disk ratio that they observe depends on diffusion.
It's a pretty extreme ratio. So
did it come down with the second year results? The first year
it did. The first year they said there was no disk at all. But I mean, that's just because the error bars were bigger. But in the second year, they detected the disk. But I mean, you know, OSSI measured the ratio. This result's been around a long time, and the ratio is always extreme. So, I think it's just hard to do with conventional astrophysics. So let me plow ahead. Celine Bohm and Ben Hooper, Joe Silk, that gang, wrote a paper almost immediately saying that you can have 3 MeV dark matter. Because if it's light enough, then you don't have to worry about producing only a few particles at very high energy. You can produce lots of particles at low energy and do this. Of course, then you throw away all the other nice things weak scale dark matter. So I found that not very appealing. And the other thing is, you know, this is not really well motivated. Whereas at least some people think dark matter at the weak scale is motivated.
And not just for the cynical reason that that's where we're building particle accelerators now. So you should only predict things that can be seen by the LHC. I mean, that would be a cynical motivation. But it is actually true, if you believe in supersymmetry, that something new is going to happen soon. Okay, so weak scale dark matter has all these nice things. So I just mean 100 GeV to TeV kind of range. And it naturally has the right cross section in the sense that 1 over a mass squared is a cross section. So 1 over this mass range squared is the cross section you need for the thermal relic density. So it just kind of wants to work in that sense.
Dark matter work as well, right? If you introduce light mediators. You need something that does the talking between the SAM model and the dark sector also and the range.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you can't do it.
No, it's not like you can't do it. I mean, they wrote a paper that does it. But I mean, even the authors of that paper kind of roll their eyes and say, yeah, it's just an idea. So they would not be able to talk about it at NYU. So the problem with doing this with weak scale dark matter is, you know, we know roughly the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy, and if we assume a mass, then we know how many annihilations there should be per second in the inner part of the galaxy. And there's enough power to make this signal with integral C's by one KV line, but there aren't nearly enough particles, which are by about a factor of 10 to the 4. So how do you make 10 to the 4 particles out of one pair? You could start a cascade if you had the right kind of cloud to do it in. But the problem is, one of the steps in the cascade is you have to take a photon and pair produce, and you need about a column density of about 10 to the 27 hydrogen atoms per square centimeter to do that.
And there just aren't any clouds with that column density. And even if there were, even if you just say, that's, say the clouds are there, whatever it takes to get the job done, the positrons you make never get out, and you never see them because the optical depth is high enough that gamma rays can't get out. So you really just can't do it.
Even though we tried. So weak scale dark matter annihilation does not work for producing this signal. Light dark matter annihilation does work, but it seems a bit contrived. So then I was at a meeting on these kinds of topics a little over a year ago, and I was, you know, where all good ideas happen, I was skipping out on the session and staring at the ceiling somewhere. And I said, the kinetic energy of the WIMPs is about right. Let's try that. So the idea is called exciting dark matter because just generically you have to have a WIMP that excites somehow. So the kinetic energy of, say, 500 GeV WIMPs moving around in the center of the galaxy is of order an MeV. It's usually less. This is the high energy tail of the distribution. I'll show you the actual plots of the velocity distributions. But it's not that far off. Now, why 500 GeV? I could have made it a TeV, and then I'd need lower velocities. But then my cross sections are kind of naturally smaller, and my number density is smaller, and it gets harder and harder to do things. So 500 GeV is a mass range that just happens to work well. So if these WIMPs have something analogous to a ground state and an excited state, and they can collisionally excite and decay and emit positron-electron pair, I don't care how they do it. If you have a model that does this, you can produce the observed signal and do lots of other fun things. So then I began to hunt for a theorist. By the way, this is, I want to emphasize, this is an existence proof. You know, any number of theories might be able to give you a similar behavior. So I'm not advocating one theory over another one. It's just if there's a way to do it, there are probably many ways to do it. So I went hunting for a theorist, and I found Neil Weiner at NYU, who is a fellow former Berkeley grad student and a smart guy and seems to be able to produce a model that'll explain anything. And he said, that's no problem. And then about a month later, after trying a few ideas, he came up with one that works. So you have your WIMPs denoted by chi coming in, exchanging a virtual boson we call phi. One WIMP, a chi star, comes out excited. That's the star. And the other WIMP comes out in the ground state. Now, we've made this coupling pretty strong. The coupling constants of order unity, it's 0.2 or something in our favorite model. And so you have to worry about multiple interactions. So you have these so-called ladder diagrams that you have to include in the calculations of the cross sections. So Neil knows how to do all that.
He must know that, right? Because
right.
You overproduce the cross section.
Well, the first version was actually a completely different model with a complex scalar. These are fermions.
No,
and it excited both.
The limit will be there, right? No matter what the particle is, right? Scalar.
No, let me finish. The point was, in that model, both of these had to get excited. And so because of that, we needed to go to a higher mass range to get the energy, and then we needed a much higher cross-section further out on the thermal tail of the distribution zone. So that model incorrectly had too high a cross-section. And so
no, that was not the reason. The reason was that it just used the Born approximation, right, for the first diagram, which as you referred to, doesn't work.
Yeah.
If you sum up the whole series, the answer is much, much more.
Yeah. Right. So he did it wrong the first time. But what's interesting about this is he actually tried something that failed. All right, so we had a big discussion at lunch about, oh, you could just write down a model and always find parameters that work. I mean, actually, a model that excites both of these, I claim there is no such model that works. Given the kinematics, you know, we know how fast things move in the Milky Way. We know we don't want to violate unitarity. I mean, we have all these constraints. So you have to excite only one of these. If you do that, then, you know, then it's okay. So there are some fairly generic things you can say here, independent of exactly what your model is. OK, so
we think this has been done correctly this time. It's been on the web since May. So if anyone has any complaints, they should speak soon. OK, so I excited a WIMP. Now I have to de-excite it. So the idea is, at its leisure, it might be a second, it might be 100 million years. At its leisure, it emits a phi. So this is the same boson we used to mediate the reaction to start with. The ground state chi goes off. This, through some weak Higgs mixing, produces an E plus E minus pair. So this is a nice way to engineer it because you know, you might have asked, why in an E plus E minus collider don't we make chis? Well, you have to make your Higgs weakly mixed to this and then somehow go upstream to get this. I mean, you just aren't going to do that. In the early universe, you'll do that. You have lots of everything running around. So in the early universe, these are all staying in thermal equilibrium just fine via reactions like this. So the fermions talk to the phis, and the phis talk to the chis, and everyone's happy. So that's good, because then the thermal relic freeze-out argument goes like usual, other than the fact that you have two kinds of chi with slightly different masses. OK, so in this model, this phi boson mass has is 10 or 100 or maybe 1,000 MeV, something in that range. That gives you the correct cross-section for scattering, which has to be in 10 to the minus 26 or 10 to the minus 27 range, a few times 10 to the minus 27. The Big Bang nuclear synthesis results are mostly unchanged, but I'll say a few words about lithium at the end. Like I said, they stay in thermal equilibrium, so that's all good. OK, so it's nice that the, you know, because the scattering is arising from a fairly light boson, that naturally has a much larger cross-section than we have for the annihilation. So the sigma annihilation over sigma scattering, this is a very rough statement because one of these depends on velocity and the other doesn't in this assumed model. This is all S-wave annihilation. You get a ratio of something like 10 to the minus 5. Now, the mass splitting of about an MeV between the ground state and the excited state is also about 10 to the minus 5 of the mass of the WIMP, or even less. But these numbers are similar. And so what that means is you get a similar amount of power out from the annihilations and from the scattering. And that's interesting to me, too. That was kind of a, well, I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but I said in an earlier slide that you get about the same amount of power in these other strange excesses that we see as you do in the 511 keV line. It's just they appear to be coming from things that are a factor of a million different in energy. So, you know, our model has these numbers very similar, and any other exciting dark matter model that you want to explain the same things also has to have that property.
It's composite, right, to have this.
It's actually not composite. It's you've added a new U1 symmetry to the model, and you weakly break it, so you have two particles that are degenerate. They're the same in everywhere, except they have a slightly different mass because they're two different linear combinations of the same fermions. And so, and the mechanism for creating the mass difference is again related to the phi. He just uses the same phi boson for everything. So the phi has a BEV, and it has a coupling to the Higgs that's the right level, and everything. You know, he just specified the phi so that you get the right mass splitting, the right cross sections for everything. Right, annihilation channels.
How many of the cars are there around today?
Yeah, so that's a good question that I was going to get to later, but they, it depends on the lifetime, which we really don't know. The natural lifetime for these is actually very long, like 100 million years. So Neil assured me he could make it a second if we had to, but if you just kind of make all of the dimensionless numbers one, and you know, just wave your hands, you end up with 100 million years, which is curious. So I'll talk about the consequences of that if I have time. OK, so how does this compare to the data? The whole point here was to make something that explains some data. So you see there's a dashed line, very faint dotted line here, actually, that is a full width half max 6-degree Gaussian in the center of the galaxy. And then we can add some constant to that if we want, because nobody knows what the zero point of the integral data is. So say we're trying to fit something roughly like that. This red line is our benchmark model. And now I'm going to take that benchmark model and sort of differentiate it with respect to the particle mass, with respect to the threshold velocity in the problem, which is related to the mass and the mass splitting. Okay, and then these are parameters relating to the shape of the halo profile and the RMS velocity in the center of the Milky Way.
And so we've made reasonable assumptions for all these parameters, and you can see that things, you know, we could get these curves to move up and down a factor of 2 pretty readily for a bunch of different things. So you could easily change the answer a factor of 16, but we don't have orders of magnitude to play with here, actually. Well, we do in one direction. We could always make the couplings weaker. So we can make this signal as small as we want, but we can't really make it very much larger. This is a pretty maximal model. So in this case, why is there, I sometimes say there's sort of only one parameter to tune. You saw all of those curves moved up and down in roughly the same way. So these parameters are fairly degenerate in terms of fitting the model. So that's a good thing because it means we can kind of make a prediction with only one free parameter. It's a bad thing if you want to measure any of those other things by using the data. Okay. Did you have?
Maybe it's more appropriate to ask at the end.
All right, so the mass of the phi and its BEV and a few other things determine the mass splitting and the cross section. And so it's appealing that you can just use the phi for everything. And it was interesting when we worked this all out first to explain the 511 kV. And then we hadn't even thought about the annihilation at all. And then somebody pointed out, you know, you could just rearrange the Feynman diagram, and if that scattering diagram exists, you must also have an annihilation diagram. And at first we were worried we would just annihilate all the dark matter away and the cross-section would be too huge. But in fact, the cross-section comes out to be just what you want, which is not too surprising, I guess, because you have a weak-scale WIMP and you end up with a weak-scale annihilation cross-section. But it's, you know, that was one of the pleasant things about the model, that we got the right annihilation cross-section after fixing the parameters to explain everything else. And the annihilation channels are important too, because we go through when we do the scattering, we go through a virtual off-shell phi, but when we annihilate, we make real phis. The phi is much, much lighter than the WIMP, right? So the WIMPs annihilate the phi is very highly boosted, but it's low mass. So it can't do anything but go to electrons, or maybe it could go to muons because of the Yukawa suppression. It cannot go to neutrinos at any reasonable level. And it can't go to photons, or we'd have other problems. So it basically can only go to E plus E minus. So that's great. We have a WIMP that goes directly to E plus E minus, which is what we wanted to explain the other things like the microwaves. So what else can we do with this? I just mentioned the microwaves. I should talk about that now. When did I start talking, Mark? Yeah, okay. Well, I will say a few things about the excess microwaves here because that ties in. So this is the good old dust map that I did as a grad student. So I'm just going to take you through a couple of the sources of microwave emission on the sky and then show you that there's some excess microwaves in the center of the galaxy that look interesting. But first I have to convince you a little bit that we know where the microwaves on the sky come from, other than the CMB. Amber always shows you the nice, beautiful CMB pictures with all this stuff subtracted. But there's a lot of junk in the way, okay? So this is the first kind of junk. This is a log stretch map that spans about 4.5 or 5 orders of magnitude. So there's a huge dynamic range to how much dust there is. The galactic center is in the center, galactic plane, obviously. And you see there's dust kind of almost everywhere on the sky. This is the H-alpha map, so this traces the ionized gas, which gives you thermal bremsstrahlung. That's just the electrons and positrons bouncing off each other. And that produces a fairly flat spectrum that's important in the middle frequency ranges, the microwaves. So that should trace the ionized gas. This traces the so-called soft synchrotron from the supernova shocks that we think are what's responsible for most of the electron cosmic rays in the galaxy and their synchrotron emission. And you see big features like this loop one feature here is famous in the synchrotron. Okay, so this is kind of spectrally the story here. We have 5 WMAP bands, and then we have the thermal dust, and that peaks up here. So this is where the dust map is made. And then we have synchrotron, that peaks at low frequencies. So we have a map here. And then for this other component, the thermal bremsstrahlung, we have the H-alpha map. So we think we understand these foregrounds pretty well. It's also something called spinning dust, but I won't talk about it. It looks like that. It's really annoying. It comes up in the middle. But we think we've got that taken care of too. So once we take all of these different components and do a multilinear regression, pull them out of the WMAP full sky maps, we see that in the inner galaxy, the inner 20 or 30 degrees, there's some additional component that we call the galactic haze. So this is what I stumbled across 4 years ago while I was doing foreground stuff, not with the WMAP team, but in the service of the WMAP team, you might say. And since I didn't get any money. I'm looking at Olivier like he would have paid me, but so anyway, this is the excess junk here, and this is you see the galactic plane has been masked out. That's not because it's too bright to deal with, but it's because the dust, the same dust that emits microwaves that causes trouble, also absorbs and scatters the H alpha light, which is just red visible light. And so we don't know if the ionized gas is in front of the dust or behind it. So where there's too much dust, we can't resolve this very well. And so that's why there's a cut here, cutting out the galactic plane. But where it's not masked out, there's some bright junk in the center. So I wrote a paper on this in 2004 and said, I don't know what's going on. Someone figure it out. And Amber Miller called. She gets the credit and said, Doug, if dark matter were annihilating in the galaxy, what would it look like? And I said, that's crazy talk, because I was, you know, an astronomer. And we talked for a while. And eventually I said, well, look, if it's really annihilating the galaxy, I already discovered it. So that, you know, that was the beginning of a multi-year effort to figure out what's going on. So this does not look very good on the screen at the moment. On my screen, this looks much bluer than this, and that's my attempt to convince you that this excess in the center that I call the haze has a much harder, much bluer spectrum than the typical synchrotron emission in the galaxy. Okay, so the very, very simple model, it's not even a model, it's just a, you know, a straw man, was that this WMAP haze is produced by 100 GeV WIMPs that magically annihilate to E plus E minus, I don't care how, as long as they go directly there. We have a sigma V of the usual thermal relic number, about a 10 microgauss field in the center of the galaxy. And then we plug all of this in and solve the diffusion energy loss equation. So that's diffusion energy loss source term gives you dT as a function of energy and position. So you solve this differential equation and ask, what is the steady state solution corresponding to any given source function? And what source function do I expect? Well, I expect the density of the dark matter in the galaxy, which I'll just assume is the good old-fashioned NFW profile, which we now know isn't such a great approximation, but it's not that bad. So you take the density squared times sigma v, that gives you the number of particles per volume per time. Okay, so then we just inject the electrons, and we get the electron population we need to produce the haze, and the excess egret gamma rays, by the way. So we have more recently solved this problem much more carefully because Dan Hooper, who's actually a particle theorist, got involved. And he said, let's just assume that the annihilations are some linear combination of quarks, gauge bosons, leptons, and so on. You know, I mean, we're annihilating standard model particles one way or another. And then we can just tweak the parameters around. So I'm running out of time, so I'll just show you this. There are two things here. This is amplitude. This is spectral hardness. The amplitude's kind of the more important one. So this is the magic number we want for the cross-section times the boost factor is just the fudge factor that people in this annihilation business refer to that magically boosts the amount of power you get out of annihilations through, you know, substructure or some other explanation. Okay, so these are different annihilation modes. This is going to E plus E minus, muons, taus. This is going to B quarks, I think. No, WZs and B quarks. Anyway, so these are different annihilation modes. The truth must be some linear combination of these. And the nice thing is these all come out about one. The only fudging that went into this, the only tuning is rather than an NFW profile, he just peaked it up a little bit and said the density goes as r to the minus 1.2 in the center instead of r to the minus 1. And that gave a better shape, actually. So he first fit the shape. He made this line go through these data points and got the right shape. And then by doing that, he also got the right amplitude for exactly the cross-section you expect from S-wave. So at the end of this, I was rather unsurprised because I did this calculation 4 years ago and got the same answer. But Dan, having done it himself with real, you know, real particle physics models, said that he thinks this is the most likely to be true of any paper he has ever written. So I want that recorded for the for posterity. It's not clear whether the confidence was over 50%, okay, but he said he had some confidence that it was actually right. So going straight to electrons is a nice feature, gives a hard spectrum with plenty of power. It's not actually required because we can, you know, you make your distribution a little peakier, you get a little more power, you change the diffusion parameters a little, you can get a little diffusion hardening. So it's not required that your WIMP go straight to electrons. But it's a nice feature of XDM that that one does go straight to electrons. So you have no trouble making a synchrotron spectrum that's hard enough to explain what we see in WMAP. I have not been able to find any other astrophysical mechanism for doing that. Okay, predictions for GLAST, just real fast here. You can ask, if all of this is true, but we're going through B quarks or something that gives you a nice cascade that produces gamma rays from the pi zeros, for example, you should see something in GLAST. If you have XDM and you're going straight to E plus E minus, you will not see this in GLAST. Okay, so this is a clear difference between the two models. But what you see for a WIMP of mass 200, 500,000 GeV are these lines on top of the underlying spectrum here is just that really super bright point source in the center of the galaxy that Hess has seen and others. So this is, if you look just in the inner little bit of the galaxy, like 0.1 degrees, and then this is if you look at a bigger annulus around that and mask out the point source, you see you have less signal overall, but the, you know, the power law part is much suppressed, so you get a really clear measurement of what's going on. So if we have a WIMP that annihilates and goes to B quarks, and it explains all these other things, these are normalized to fit all the other measurements we want to fit, then this signal must be here. If it's not, we only have two options. One is none of this stuff is coming from WIMPs, period. The other is we have a WIMP that doesn't go through B quarks or gauge bosons or anything that would give you some gamma rays, okay? So you can do this for the different channels. Here's W plus W minus, here's going to Zs. Tau's, mu's, electrons. You see, if you go to mu's or electrons, you really have a problem here. It's not good. And so when XDM goes to mu's or electrons, for actually not entirely the same reason, but almost, it's also not good. But going to more massive things, we should definitely see gamma rays with BLAST. So we're very excited to see what BLAST sees next year. So just to wrap this up, the original naive scenario that was cooked up for the microwave haze was just we wanted a weak scale WIMP that went to electrons at least some of the time, or all of the time would be even better. And everyone said, you can't do that. And what I think they meant is you can't do that in minimal supersymmetry, right? You're just not going to go straight to E plus E minus. But if you're, you know, if you go off and build this other model to explain something completely unrelated, then you accidentally stumble on a model that does just this. So I thought that was, that was a neat thing that we found exactly what we needed without contriving anything. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but without contriving anything to fit this, it just works. Okay, so then you've seen me show a bunch of different calculations here. I've used different mass profiles for the galaxy. You may be starting to worry that I use a different mass profile each time until I get the answer I want. So to address that worry, we took a look at a simulation by Fabio Governato and his group at Washington, Tom Quinn and those folks. And these three of these are galaxies produced in their simulation. And they have been pushed through the sunrise radiative transfer code with all of the dust and radiative transfer stuff to make them look like real galaxies in the Sloan bands. Chris Burke did this. So Chris Burke did not write sunrise. He made this figure. And so the question here is, I'm sure David Hogg can tell me, because he's made images of the 10,000 favorite galaxies, which of these are real and which are the simulation, since these are Sloan filters. And you can't tell. And you might say, oh, that looks very regular. That must be a simulated one. No, that's a real one. That's a simulated one. So it's interesting. So the idea here was that maybe in general, when we have a bunch of free parameters about the Milky Way, maybe we should just tie them to some simulation rather than making stuff up. And even if the simulation isn't a perfectly faithful representation of our galaxy, at least it has no free parameters, and they're physically self-consistent with each other. So, you know, at least you have something. And this is a very impressive simulation. It reproduces a lot of things about our galaxy, right down to the ages and metallicities of the stellar populations and lots of things. It's pretty cool. So in the original paper, Neil and I assumed that the velocity distribution of WIMPs in the inner part of the galaxy is a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution truncated at the escape velocity, and then we need the pairwise relative distribution, so you can involve that with itself, right? And so this curve is what we assumed, and this histogram is what comes out of the simulation as being the correct pairwise relative velocity distribution. And I just about fell out of my chair when I saw how well that fits. This is the escape velocity here. And so I'm kind of showing you, if we hadn't truncated at the escape velocity, it would feel like that. But it does the right thing. There's a very slight excess here. Maybe these are particles cruising in for the first time, and they're not completely bound yet. So now we can fit this. So this is actually the equation for a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution truncated, convolved with itself. I'm sure you all knew that. And we fit this in different radial bins as we go out in the galaxy. And of course, the velocity dispersion, well, not of course, in this simulation, the velocity dispersion happens to drop a little bit as you go out. It drops something like r to the minus 1/4. So this would be another good thing to explain if somebody knows any fundamental reason why that's true. So you do all of this. This is the bottom line here. One of these curves is the prediction from the simulation of what the pair intensity, so the number of pairs created per second per square centimeter per steradian, along lines of sight to this angle from the center of the galaxy. So this is what integral 511 kV lines look like. And the other line is what it actually does look like. And I've forgotten which one is which, because they're so similar. So this has no new free parameters other than what we did in our original paper. So this means two things. The assumptions we made in that paper are, well, OK, they aren't necessarily reflective of how the Milky Way is, but they're sure reflective of how this simulation of the Milky Way is. Kind of miraculous. So that's it for the evidence. I can just mention very quickly here a couple different things you might look into. So there's heating of clusters. OK, if dark matter can inelastically scatter and produce pairs, that can produce possibly interesting amounts of heating in clusters. And there's been a long-standing problem in astrophysics of how to keep the clusters from catastrophically cooling and collapsing, because we know how fast the X-ray energy is coming out of the clusters, and we know the thermal timescales and so on. And at least in a lot of cases, they should have substantial amounts of gas falling into the center, and they don't. So sometimes you get out of this with AGN and say they can produce a lot of power. But, you know, eminent people like Jerry Oestreicher will tell you the duty cycle of AGN is too small for this, and you really can't get enough power out of that. There are other ways to get power, too. This actually doesn't give you enough power, but it does something interesting. It gives you a thermostat. There's a paper a couple of years ago by Iago Ascacibar that tried to explain the heating with dark matter annihilation. That doesn't work because as a galaxy starts to collapse and the density of the dark matter goes up and the density of the gas goes up, if the cooling goes to density squared and the heating goes to density squared, you never halt the collapse. But this goes as density squared times a function of velocity. So it pushes back. So you start to collapse, you should bounce and stabilize somewhere. So this mechanism can provide a thermostat that makes clusters stable if you have some other source that provides a significant fraction of the heating. This can do something to black hole formation. Just because if dark matter can inelastically scatter and lose energy, it must be easier for it to fall into a black hole than if it doesn't. And then you can play around with 21 centimeter, ask if you can make phis and accelerators, ask about lithium abundance. Skip through all that, just say lithium abundance, these are the constraints. So this is more or less how much of a particle I have and how long it lives. Okay, so a particle that decays with some lifetime in the early universe. And so in this how much of it and how long it lives plane, there's a sweet spot that's either here or here, depending on whose measurements you believe, but somewhere in this neighborhood, where you get the primordial abundances right for everything. And the problem is that if our particle, if our phi has a lifetime of 1,000 seconds, the abundance is way, way, way high. So we can't do this. We can't solve the lithium abundance problem. But we can have a short lifetime for the phi and be over here where we actually, we don't fix the lithium problem, but if we ignore the lithium curve, just like everyone else who ever does BBN ignores it, then we're just as bad as everyone else. So we haven't fixed the problem, but we haven't made it worse. So this is sort of evidence that the phi lifetime is not 1,000 seconds. It's probably much shorter.
Yes, exactly. It has to decay hydrogen. Right. Yeah, so we discussed the option that the phi would be massive enough to go to pions instead of mu's or electrons. And we might be willing to make that sacrifice if it had fixed the lithium problem. But since it doesn't, we're not going there.
Energy density in the universe, right? If you make it live that long at the time when helium is formed, the universe is dominated by phi. So that's.
Because
it's an initial disturbance.
Yeah, exactly.
So nothing would work until unless this particle decays up under a second.
Yeah, exactly. Now, to answer Katie's question, you might ask how many excited Kais are there today, because you did ask that. And at first, we were very, very worried, because in the early universe, half of the Kais are excited and half aren't, because they have the same masses. And if half of them were still excited and they had 100 million or a billion year lifetime to de-excite, we'd be in big trouble, because then we'd dump a huge amount of energy. Right, we dump hundreds of keV or an MeV or something per win at much later times, at rates of 10 or 20 or 30 or whatever. So we would not only reionize the universe, we would fry the universe, we would destroy the CMB, so it's a disaster. So we thought that might have actually killed the whole idea of excited dark matter. But then we thought a little harder, and actually these WIMPs stay in collisional equilibrium much longer than they stay in annihilation equilibrium. So they freeze out, their mass density freezes out, but they're still scattering off each other all the time for a much longer period of time. And so you actually get an excitation fraction freeze out also by the same arguments. And so you can ask, what is the excitation fraction relic density? And depending on the assumptions we make for the particle physics, between 1% and 10 to the minus 4. So actually that's not enough to wreck the universe. On the high end of that, it is enough to do something interesting to reionization, but this is by no means a claim that we're actually reionizing the universe at redshift 10 or whatever, but that actually we don't, that's not a constraint that can destroy the model. So that was a relief. So I think I better stop there.
I'm forgetting how the microwave haze works. So you have 100 GeV particles. How do you get the microwaves out of this?
Well, or 500 GeV, right? Anything that range.
Yeah, but
and it's just synchrotron. So you're making E plus E minus, either directly or indirectly.
So what are the energy E plus E minus supposed to be?
Well, next year they come out with them, half the mass of the WIMP, actually. So if it's a 500 JeV X dam width, then they're 250 JeV E plus or minus.
Okay, so can you explain the heat thing?
Well, the problem is the heat bump is actually at quite a bit lower energy. So you either have to wait for them to all diffuse out here. Mm-hmm. And I think someone in Tarley's group had a model that did that or something. But
well, we wrote a paper.
Are you okay? You wrote a paper that did that. Okay.
No, not all. Well, anyway.
Some crazy person wrote something about that.
We just did straight annihilation.
Maybe I'm thinking of something different.
Anyway, we should talk about it.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you could cook something up.
If you could.
Cook something up, that would do it.
Yeah. Well.
Did you try?
You might be thinking.
I didn't try, honestly. I'm actually just waiting to see what Pamela says. Right, because it's quite...
Pamela, or what did you say?
Yeah, Pamela.
Yeah, whatever. All right, Pamela. Okay.
It's quite possible that, you know, yeah, it will show all the previous measurements are wrong,
true,
but then there's some bump out over here.
True.
So let's just wait until we have error bars that are small.
Fine.
And if there's really something there, it might be possible to explain it. But we looked at that a little bit, and it didn't really want to work. We wanted to make a bump at higher energies and not down where it's observed. So, I don't know. We can't explain everything.
Okay.
Do you want the microphone here?
Sure. Yeah, let's take it again.